from the stakeholders groups. And we are pleased to have Barney Speight and Jeff Guilfoy with us. Barney obviously representing the Oregon Health Plan stakeholders group, and Jeff representing the mental health group. We've never had both of you here before, so you can either come up together or separately, or come together. What the heck? I mean, come there's security in numbers.
Beatles song?
Beatles song, huh?
Yeah.
Pull those mics real close, because I'm not. That's not close enough. You got to kind of get them right up there.
Think of it as an ice cream cone, and you want to lick it.
Does someone else lick this besides?
Whoever.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeff Guilfoyne. I'll go ahead and go first and give the committee a progress report, because so far we have not had the opportunity to report to the committee. For the record, I am a private consultant with Aldridge Kilbride and Tatone, and was asked to facilitate this task force to look at the mental health budget. And our charge, as it was given to us, basically was this: to recommend to this committee and also to the Ways and Means Committee how to allocate approximately $475 million of total funds among the state's various mental health programs and services. We've got a very good group of individuals to work with. It's really a top-notch group. And this amount that we're working with, as you all know, is significantly less than the governor's balanced budget amount, and significantly less than, if we use the term current service level, it's significantly less than what that would be as well, too. Our committee has met three times. We meet on Tuesdays and Thursday nights from 6 o'clock until 8 o'clock, and we have three meetings left before we finish up our work. When trying to look at this issue of the $475 million, we came up really with three possible approaches. The first approach would say this, that we would just simply start from ground zero and build up services from the ground up until we hit the $475 million, much the way the Oregon Health Plan was originally conceived. And then that would be one alternative. The second alternative would be to start from the top of the existing system, recognizing that that system is in place, and start to peel back dollars from that system until we reach the $475 million. Or the third alternative, which is a little bit of a hybrid of both, would be to build that level of services based on the most important services to preserve, the next most important services to preserve, and so forth. We looked at all three of those models. What we decided is important was for us to first of all understand what parts of the system are the parts of the system that it would be unlikely over the next 2 years that we could either dismantle or reallocate those dollars. In other words, what parts of the system are much less flexible and much more inclined to be things that we will have to maintain a status quo on over the next 2 years, and how much of the budget does that take up? And Barry Cast, who's the administrator of the Health Services Cluster at the Department of Human Services, did an excellent array for us. And actually, I think we have a copy of this for you. Kelly, do you have a copy of this? And we'll hand this out to you and just spend a few minutes talking through it. Mr. Chair, what you have before you is a list of all of the services other than alcohol and drug that are provided by the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And you can see that in total at the bottom of that list that they total about $384 million. That doesn't include about $90 million of alcohol and drug money. But what Barry did for us was went through, and you'll see on the right-hand column, it says flexibility rating, and it will say either H, M, or L. And what we asked him to do was to define these services this way. Low flexibility means that it's unlikely you can do much with the funds or the delivery system for the 0305 biennium, much different than what you're currently doing. Basically, you're looking at status quo because of the type of service and, again, because of how these services are delivered. The Oregon State Hospital system is probably a good example, particularly the forensics function over in the state hospital. So that was what low flexibility meant. The second array was medium flexibility, which means that you could make some changes in the program and how it's delivered, but it would require a transition. It might also require some additional support services that are not presently in the system, maybe some funding or financing to build facilities or some of those kinds of things. And then the third category that's on there were the high flexibility services, and these are services that you could more rapidly deploy or change the model and potentially provide those locally. And if you look at how all those dollars add up, what you see is that a significant chunk of the total dollars are tied up in the low flexibility area, approximately two-thirds of it. So as the group looked at that, I think it was a little bit disappointing, a little bit shocking, because it really tells us a lot that we don't have a lot of options for the next 2 years when you really start to look at this system. The task force, I believe, is really struggling with those issues. And there's really about four issues they're struggling with. The first one is there's not enough money to do much revamping of the system, not only that, but there's also nowhere near the money in the system right now that it would take to adequately fund what we're doing right now. So they're really dealing with trying to spread out money that is already inadequate and then trying to figure out, is there a better way to spend an inadequate amount of money? So I think that's the first thing that they struggle with. The second thing is that a substantial portion of the money is tied up in this low flexibility category of services, and that these basically are going to have to be provided in 03-05 the same way they're provided now, because there just isn't enough funding to run the status quo and transition to new services at the same time. And then the third area they're struggling with is that if there were dollars for providing more local services, it's possible that they could leverage more federal funds and put more funds into the system. However, if the wrong services and some of the high flexible services are, quote, the wrong kinds of services, if the wrong kind of services are pushed out to the local level, you could actually lose match and have less match available to you. And then finally, unlike the Oregon Health Plan discussions, and I know those are really no easier because Barney and I have talked about those, in those discussions, a lot of it centers around deciding what services should be provided using the funding and still figuring out some way to draw a line. The mental health process can't quite work this way, and our task force can't quite work this way, because we're dealing with a very complex delivery system that's a patchwork of things that are provided by the state, things that are provided locally, things that are provided by various providers that the state contracts with, and a whole number of partners. And in addition to that, sometimes these groups are all working interdependently. Sometimes they're working independently. And then if you look around the state, the services are provided at different levels and with different types of services, depending on where you are. So this makes it difficult to create a total local system, with an anticipated level of funding, you know, that they could really expect to have. And it also makes it very difficult when you start to have discussions about how much of the status quo should you change. It makes it very difficult to say we would have any kind of consistency or consistent level of services statewide. So I think what ultimately happens is they come back as providers of these services and they just say this is almost an impossible, unconscionable way to have to try to figure this system out. Now, having said that, I also think everybody in that room, there's nobody in that room that's naive. Everybody in that room understands not only what you all are up against in every single facet of the budget that you're dealing with, but they also understand that you are looking to them and counting on them to work together to try to do the very best job and to help you prioritize those services and figure out how do we do the best with what we have. And all of them have committed that they're still with us. And we're halfway finished with our sessions. We really only have three more sessions. But all of them still are at the table and still are trying to work collaboratively and constructively. We're working very hard to bring an acceptable level of a set of recommendations to you and also to the Ways and Means Committee. And I hope the next time that I report to you that we will be there with that list of recommendations for you. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. Thanks, Jeff.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, Jeff, so I can make sure I understand this correctly, I was trying to make sure that low flexibility, I'm looking on be the third page, which is number 37. It says MHS special projects, mental health services within the scope, and it's by project. And it says low flexibility. Is that low flexibility because the projects have already been designated and are running as projects, or that there's money available for new projects?
Representative March, I believe it is the former that you just said.
Okay, thank you.
And I have to confess, I am not an expert in the details of all of these services. I don't know if Barry Cast is here, but he certainly could fill us in it.
Okay, thank you.
And there's another connotation to low flexibility, just not that the money's been spent. You know, it'd be extraordinarily hard to unwind those. Break them down into any type of components or subsets within the amount of time that we have, you know, in this session.
Right.
And then another criteria is, can you implement it quick enough in the next biennium where you would be able to get any meaningful amount of dollars out of it? So, I mean, there are a couple of variables into why some of these are designated low and then, to a lesser extent, medium. Really, the highs are the ones where we have some
fungibility, sort of.
Yeah, fungibility or flexibility. I think one of the interesting things that Jeff pointed out, you look at this macro number that we've got, it's probably even lower now after yesterday's announcement, which will become official tomorrow with regard to the revenue loss. But you look at that 475. And out of that 475, you've got to look at the Oregon State Hospital, and that's 131, you know, just the way it is. And getting some of those populations out of there, the only one that's really flexible to any degree are the children and GEO population, and there we already get the federal match.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chair, the civil commitment folks are flexible too.
Yeah, the civil commitment folks, and we could pick up. I mean, this is difficult.
Sure. We get into bricks and mortars if we do that. So.
Yeah, you got to start building stuff.
Well, and where do you put the people that are civilly committed if you don't put them here?
Well, the point there, Representative March, is the fact that in the state hospital, it's all general fund. If we were in community settings, 16.
Beds or less.
16 beds or less, we get Medicaid match. So, you know, but that's some of the dynamics we're trying to wrestle with in that group is, this would make sense. How do you make it happen? So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Representative Greenlee.
When we're talking about lower, higher, medium flex, we're talking basically about the general fund component of that?
Yes, Representative Greenlee. And oftentimes it talks about the federal funds only to the extent of how it's matched and all, but it is basically low flexibility, but it's also low flexibility for delivery. It, you know, there's not a lot of options to quickly fire up some other kind of delivery mechanism.
But you have some sense of what these other funds are and the extent to which they have the potential flexibility of increasing them rather than...
I don't have that answer for you, exactly what they are. Barney, do you know?
I can give partial answers since I was observing. Many of the other funds around the Oregon State Hospital are either Medicare reimbursements, because some of the patients are Medicare eligible, and some are basically self-pay.
Yeah. Please.
Fees, so that they have some degree of ability to pay for the services themselves. Those are the two areas that I recall.
And I suspect this one above, under special projects, are probably NIMH or something funds that have come in from some places. Maybe something like that, because they're project funds. Is there any possibility of raising? That was the question I had. Of increasing funding from private pay or insurance or other things? Was that discussed at all?
We have not discussed that specifically, but Bernie, do you have an answer?
No, I don't. I mean, and we can clearly ask tonight for Barry Cast's thoughts on that.
One more from Kaiser or something like that.
Tap into retirement funds.
No, they're gone. Yeah, you won't get mine.
This has been a extraordinarily difficult traverse so far, and if there's one sentiment, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, Jeff or Barney, but if there's one sentiment that I keep hearing out of the group and I keep hearing from clients and advocates is that the most important component to the whole thing is the pharmaceutical component. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe we'll start going down that path tonight again. I mean, the mental health delivery system is somewhat fractured.
I would assume it was once together.
Not necessarily. How about multifaceted? Okay, many silos, muy silos, and there isn't just one type of answer you can come up with. I mean, it's very much unlike Oregon Health Plan, where a lot of the same players are dancing around the same apple that we've been dancing around forever. And so, I mean, there's a much greater consensus when the health plan folks sit down and say, okay, scarce resources, what are we going to do, than there is at mental health. I don't know how to sum it up any differently than that, Jeff. Any other questions for a report on our mental health stakeholders group? Mitch.
Yeah. Was there any discussion on the mental health block grant, where how that's being used and where that is? And is it still there? I mean, the SAMHSA funds are still in the block grant somewhere.
Do you know to what extent, Barney, there are block grant amounts?
There was this, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, there was discussion of block grants as an alternative concept, and I think that discussion will continue tonight. Because the block, and I'm trying to answer your question indirectly, what I heard particularly from community mental health administrators, county and MHO, is that the block grant, well, county, that the block grant gives them increased flexibility to adapt delivery and administrative techniques to meet their community needs. And so there's a high degree of favorability toward block grants. There was not a lot of comments specifically about their role right now.
Well, but what I'm talking about is the federal block grant that comes.
Is this block?
That's a list of the federal block grants there, isn't it, Bruce?
I'm talking about what's happening with the federal block grant coming to us. I mean, have you discussed it?
It was just handed to me by Mr. There was a handout given, and we can make this available. It was not discussed, but it did portray where the block grants were going by county. There's about $1.3 million in, 4.4 million, both adult and children, in block grants across the state. And I'll make this available by county. In some counties, it's relatively modest. In others, it's a substantial amount of money.
So that's the amount of the federal block grant that's being transferred to counties.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yes.
Is there some? Okay.
I mean, that's not really in the purview of our discussion. That's there. It's coming in whatever level. And so we're dealing with the general fund portion.
Well, where it's in discussion was my sense that some of that block grant money got into the mix of how we were paying for Oregon Health Plan services. And I have a fear that, and I expect that's true of A&D, but I'm not sure about mental health. That's why I was asking that question. I'm afraid that somewhere along the line we're going to lose the flexibility of that money. That money's falling off the table somewhere. That's all I wanted to make sure was not happening, so that we could use it for the things we need to do. That was.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to make a statement here that there may be others in the audience that can correct me, but I don't believe what you said is true, is that the that they're kind of commingled with the OHP mental health and chemical dependency funds. In fact, the OHP mental health and chemical dependency are on our blackboard in the OHP and are kind of separate from the discussions of the mental health group looking at community mental health services, which include the block grants, and then you know the more institutional state types of services, and they're looking to us with a great deal of concern, and I believe state administrators are looking at it because the role of the OHP mental health benefit for a mandatory population is an essential core to have a local mental health delivery system. And so making sure we can protect that as much as possible, and I'll get into this a little bit, is very important. Understanding that the standard population, for example, now doesn't have, as of March 1, doesn't have a mental health benefit. But there are two separate pots. There's OHP mental health, and then there's the 470 plus million that Jeff's talking about is really is the focus of the mental health work group. And it really, as I said last time, it's going to be important at some point, whether it's the last meeting or if we have one special meeting, is to try to craft these recommendations and integrate them to see how they fit, both from the logic that there's mental health on both sides, but also there has to be some rationale between the fit between mental health policy and physical health policy for the Oregon Health Plan. I hope that's responsive, but that's what I hear.
Well, let me just try one more, if I may, Mr. Chair. It's that my understanding was that the SAMHSA A&D block grant, that some of the SAMHSA A&D block grant did get commingled in some way and in the production of A&D services for the 118,000. And I was just I keep trying to ask that question if that's true or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, I do not know if that's true, but I will try to get you an answer to that.
It's my sense that that is not, but that's a fair question.
Well, what I heard was that there was a trade-off for buying residential services where the block grant was moved over to cover some residential services that might not otherwise have been covered, then freeing up some general fund money to move over so it could be matched on the Medicaid side for A&D services for that expanded population. If that's the case, if it is true, and it may not be true, but it's what I think I heard, and I want to make sure that use of the A&D block grant for inpatient services could be pulled out and used for ambulatory if it's available, and therefore used as a matching. But I may just have gotten that wrong.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, we can sure check on that and get back to you.
Yeah, and it'd only be the 37,291st time you've been wrong today. So
No, that overestimates slightly.
I think that's a good question, Mitch, and we'll get that part figured out. What Barney is alluding to, what is critical, and where these two need to come together, is in some of the buyback stuff that the OHP group is struggling to get to. Is mental health services for a mandatory minimum Medicaid level, and addiction services for that mandatory minimum, and it's about 28, 29 million bucks for the mental health services and 10 or 12 for the addiction services. And, you look at the amounts of money that are involved here and you think, well, we ought to be able to do that. We've been working in the OHP side pretty diligently trying to figure out how to get there. Any other questions? Oh.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, I've heard privately from a number of individuals, and it may be part of your discussion, that at the Oregon State Hospital there are a number of people who could be moved to a less restrictive setting in the community. Has that been talked about?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, they have talked about that, and I think we're going to probably talk more about that as well, too. One of the things that has come out of the conversations also is the dependency on having a facility like the Oregon State Hospital, whether it's the campus that's here or somewhere else, as a fallback, and we've actually talked about the possibility of even counties being able to negotiate, space at the state hospital, depending on how this service delivery model ultimately comes out. I think we'll continue to talk about those options.
Well, one of the difficulties that a lot of the counties have is when they have a prisoner in their jails who really belongs in a mental health facility, there is no place for them. And Oregon State Hospital has been full, and they've been backed up. There's been some disasters because of it.
Yeah. Well, and then what's been happening is they're using Eastern Oregon as overflow, and if that wasn't, such a vital link, it'd be a heck of a lot easier to close Eastern than, obviously, the main state hospital. So this is tough stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I characterized it to the group as, hey, we've got to walk over broken glass together.
Josephine.
So,
look at that.
Any other mental health type questions? OHP stakeholder. Barney, you're on.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. The OHP stakeholder group has met four evenings, 8 hours. We concluded our fourth meeting last night. We are at a state, we had last week when I reported to you kind of in depth, I want to make this a little more highly in an overview. We're really looking now at some estimates or scenarios of what it would cost to buy services for a mandatory minimum Medicaid population, mandatory Medicaid minimum level
Arnie,
of service.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Do we have copies of this?
No.
No, I don't think we have. Although they're available if you want to pass them out.
Yeah, hand them out.
Okay. They're probably a different. Make sure I have one because I'm looking from a different sheet.
Which one?
I want to get in the right hymnal.
Is that the same one from last night?
The middle one.
February 21st?
One.
Yeah. That's the unit of February 21st.
Some utilization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three bars.
Okay. Yeah, I would use this. I'd caution you that this is more illustrative than definitive because we do have this is 24th. Okay. I'm looking down at the bottom.
24th is okay. Yeah.
Yeah,
I got confused.
I want to get to the right number here. We've worked it. Okay, this is
kind of. Mr. Chair, while he's looking, I would like to state for the record that Monday night, Representative Bates cost the state a heck of a lot of money.
Yes,
he did.
Well, he didn't really cost the state very much money at all, but he cost the group a fair amount of gasping and took me back to basic arithmetic, and I appreciate that.
I'd like to say for the record that I found a large mathematical error that unfortunately didn't go in the direction the group wanted to go in, but it was reality.
Yeah, this is,
okay.
And this isn't the one that we were working off of the other night, by the way.
No, I want to point out that what's been handed out is illustrative of the kind of framework we're working within. What's been handed out to you, the top is a summary of the governor's balanced budget. And if you'll notice that, I just point to the 992.1 figure at the bottom there where it says total, subtotal state funds, 992.1. That's what's in the governor's balanced budget proposal, and we have been working from a number less than that since the beginning because of knowing that the revenue projections that were in the governor's budget were developed prior to some of the more known softness in revenue, including what was yesterday. So we've been working to a target of $933 million of state funds. You can just cross off 992.1 and put 993, and that, excuse me, 933.0, and that's been kind of a working target. Against which we're trying to determine how much services can we buy for how many people. Now, if I take you down to the next box. Again, this is one scenario. You can see that the cost of the OHP for state funds would be $765 million away from that $993. The balance would then be available, and I don't have the arithmetic right there. That would be about
$168.
Okay. You can see that we have $168 million left. And then what's portrayed in the bottom box are four very essential, what we call buybacks, for benefits that are not within the...
Barney, I pointed out that those numbers did not include the mental health kids, the mandatory, so that would be, you'd have to take, what, $25 million additional off of that?
We're getting a more updated sheet.
Oh, okay.
Being delivered.
The bottom line to this, regardless of what numbers you're looking at, is that, and what I was going to report, is that if we have 933 as a target, and we have an estimate of what it costs to buy the middle box, then what's left over, if it's a positive number, is what's available to add benefits for that population. And in the sheet you're looking at, you can see 168 does not buy all of the benefits for prescription drug, durable medical equipment, mental health, and addiction services. We've looked at several iterations of this. There was a calculation mistake in the early drafts that we had because some children's services weren't in. Where we have ended up as a model to talk from is that, and what I decided last night I would report to you, is that we think we're about somewhere between 100 to $120 million short of being able to provide a mandatory program to minimum mandatories eligibles, including the four benefit packages that are below. And what we did last night then was to begin to brainstorm, to put potential action items on a list to say, how can we buy the services, whether they be in the physical health arena or in the four additional benefit clusters below, how can we buy those services cheaper so that we can at least bring that full package to the defined populations? How can we save out of this estimated budget somewhere between $100 and $125 million? And we have put together a list. Last night we spent about an hour and a half looking across what I'd call all provider groups, looking at utilization. Are there methods to change the rate of utilization? Are there methods to change the input prices at the unit price level? Looking at it both in fee-for-service and in the managed care domain. And again, as I said earlier, looking at it from the pharmaceutical benefit program, the hospital, the physician, the administration of the program, both administration within FCHP and elsewhere. And what our task is, particularly from next Monday night and for the subsequent, is to really try to begin to prioritize where we believe, if there's a list of 38 possible interventions, some may have real value. Some may have value but only over the longer haul and may not have much feasibility in the short term, and some may not have a lot of value at all, value in the sense of actually saving a lot of money. And we're going to try to be able to put together a list that we can get costed out and then develop to see what kind of consensus can be developed across the group of interests that are in the room to hit that target, and of saving somewhere between $100 and $120 million. It is very difficult, and I believe that what I saw last night, and I'd look to the members of the legislature who were there, is that every interest group, every stakeholder at the table is engaged. It's all on the table. We're beginning to talk about things that we in the Northwest are oftentimes we're very kind to each other and don't talk openly and candidly about some of the, and we've got a little bit of that on the table. The group dynamics are getting more serious, and I think we've got a list of interventions that some are very serious in their consequences, and you know, putting together a list of what I'd call multidisciplinary trade-offs, where everybody's belt goes in a notch, is probably what we're trying to do. As I pointed out last meeting, we do have a set of principles. Equity is one of them. We also realize that as we get very serious about this, we'll probably violate every principle that's on that sheet, but if we can do it with some degree of even-handedness, we will have achieved something. And I would close my remarks by saying I think that as uncomfortable as all of the stakeholder groups are with this process is the realization that, with all due respect to the budget process in this state or any place else, is there are informed ways to make budgetary reductions and there are less informed ways. And at least this is a quasi-informed way. And I would hope that whatever recommendation comes to this body and ultimately gets to Ways and Means, that people will appreciate this is not easy for the groups to come up with, but I think they realize that it is a more informed way to make very distasteful kinds of reductions that do have human consequences. And I saw the same thing, the same level of seriousness but recommitment in the mental health group. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions and look to others that have participated if I've mischaracterized anything.
Do you want to describe the second sheet at all, Barney, the utilization only, and folks can see the difference between, you know, what the utilization is and how we're thinking about handling?
Yes, the first sheet that was handed out was no utilization. The one that you first received, the costs, the $765 million that's in that middle box, state funds, does everybody see that? That is an estimate of the cost of the mandatory program without any built-in utilization increases or cost of service increases, i.e. provider reimbursement, for the 03-05 biennium. The second sheet that you have before you, compare the 765 to in that same and on the second sheet, and it's $830 million. And what that difference of $65 million is the estimated cost of actuarial estimates of the increased utilization of services. This would be not only in the number of services, but the intensity and mix of services, taking into account medical technology and other phenomena like that. This sheet, the second sheet that you looked at, has no changes in provider reimbursement built in. It's when it says utilization increases only, it's an actuarial estimate of just utilization intensity and mix with no cost. And the third sheet, the third example we looked at, they don't have it. I'll just give you a sense. When you put the cost increases, the $830 million goes up to $846.1 million.
And that would be provider reimbursements.
So you can see that the bulk of the, a substantial portion of the increase is utilization. There's also, I think, a desire to avoid trying to develop from a scenario that takes into account no utilization and no cost, because it's unrealistic to build a budget for a biennium without some utilization factor in it. Otherwise, we'll just be back here mid-biennium. So those are the kinds of what I call macro scenarios we're working from, and now I think we're going to be moving into these numbers, whether it be in the RX portion below or in the physical health portion above, of where can we find savings, where can we find utilization efficiencies. There's clearly going to be some tough discussions about pricing and networks. We've talked about admin, both FCHP, the fully capitated health plan admin, and state admin. We've talked about, are there savings in the fee-for-service domain? These budgets are put together assuming that about 40% of the cost is fee-for-service. Fee-for-service, while it has some management from the state level, doesn't has some very dramatic differences in utilization and therefore cost. And so if we can save money in fee-for-service, that will actually give us a dollar potentially to put into a managed care domain and be able to provide enhanced services. So we're looking, I think we had a pretty good discussion last night of looking across the board. There's going to be a lot of data requests, and we're going to have to prioritize those, but my attempt to give you a feel of how we're pushing forward on this.
Do you have just a laundry list off the top of your head, Barney, of the type of areas where...
Yeah, I'll give you an example, and I took my chart notes, and the staff, again, doing great work, and we've got about 33 items. They're out now for review by the group, but just to give you a feel, using a generics first step therapy in pharmaceutical, lowering the SCHP admin fee. I'm going to try to give you a sense that's across so that everybody's ox is being gored here in my remarks. Eliminating the primary case management fee for primary care physicians. Better screening of eligibility, particularly for on income-related clients. Enhanced prior authorization for select prescription drugs. What's the feasibility from a federal approval point of view of overlaying the prioritized list on the mandatory services? There's actually, if we could do that, there's 6.5% built into some budget assumptions. We have to look at what that looks like and also understand how could we develop a request with the federal for the federal government, because the feeling is right off the top they'd probably say no. In more supplemental rebates on brands and generics, managing hospital stays and fee-for-service because there is about a 10% difference in utilization of hospital days and admits and fee-for-service. If we could change that by 2, 3, 4%, that's a lot of money. And we would be using tools that are already used in managed care anyway, so there should be no differentiating in quality or outcome. It's just a different savings from resources. Pick out a couple more here. Tightening the comorbidity rules around the prioritized list. Looking at our disease, there's a disease management contract within the fee-for-service program. Looking at, is that really going to provide savings, or are there better ways to do that? Give you a sense of the scope across both provider types and program types.
Thank you.
Question?
Of course, Representative Mona Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your list, do you include expediting eligibility into the SSI program? Could that be a part of that or not? I'm just thinking I have constituents who have had to wait up to 3.5 years before they could get onto SSI. They eventually did, but there's a reason to have a delay, but it would be nice to have a cap of 2 years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson, I'll look into that. We had some discussions around eligibility issues, and one of the questions in kind of adding that as a subnote under eligibility is to see how much of that is a federal problem versus a state problem. Because my instinct tells me some of these delays may actually be driven by either federal policy or federal administrative actions, but I'll make sure that that's looked at. Okay.
Representative Greenlee.
Barney, I have two questions for you, if I may, Mr. Chair. That pesky $120 million of other funds is still disappeared, but 40 comes back on drugs, so some of that must be out of the drug side, is that?
Yes, in fact, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I'll follow up, if not tomorrow, early next week. I've talked to people about that pesky $100 million in other funds, and people that are smarter than me have told me that there's an underlying rationale that can be explained, and we need to get that back to you.
Yeah, the other question I have is, I really remember quite well in the design of the Oregon Health Plan, the work done by Oregon Health Decisions that looked at values, went across the citizenry of the state and got some sense of what values people think ought to guide this to add to the, I think this is an illuminated discussion because it brings budget numbers and assumptions very nicely, but I was wondering if values are being factored into that, and the thing that triggered in my mind was the fact that CHIP doesn't show up as a sample option, the reduction of which flies in the face of what the original values were to front load preventive and primary care services for kids, and the fact that it also meets the criteria. It's a 2.5-to-1 match.
Correct.
And I was wondering why.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, and I'm glad you raised this because it's important for you to know and for the public that's listening to know, is we have focused first on the mandatory populations. We have both on our list to look at, and we have segmented the CHIP funds on a separate table. So they're not included in here. The money isn't spent in here, and the policy area will have follow-up discussion for both CHIP and FEOP, which are two separate items in both funding and populations. So in that sense, we are preserving the concept, I think, in an operational sense, of holding the CHIP money off the table to see how much we can do for kids under the Title 19 and then bring that back in, because one of the principles that we laid out in our first meeting was vulnerability, which included both the elderly and children, and leverage. And the CHIP program brings higher leverage. So that is on the table. And will be addressed.
So part of the process will be comparing non-mandatory expanded services for mandatory populations with expanding populations.
Correct.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, I want to thank you first for all the work you've done every night for us. It's been a long and torturous battle, and I appreciate the work everybody else has been doing. People in this committee have been there with us. I want to define things a little more globally for some people who might be listening or may not understand it as well as you do and you live it. We're talking about starting a program within the constraints of the money we have available to us. The first thing we have to do under those constraints is construct or reconstruct the minimum mandatory federal program that allows us to be a Medicaid program. And that means looking at the mandatory population and what we have to give them in that mandatory population to qualify for the Medicaid match. And that's where we're at. And when we got to that point, which took some effort, we have found that we can cover those people, but they won't have a pharmacy benefit, they won't have mental health, they won't have A&D, they won't have the things that most people would assume to be part of a normal health care plan. And now we're looking at what can we add back with the money that's available and trying to produce more money that's available through efficiencies, which would then allow us to get into questions like FEOP, SCHIP, medically needy, and other programs that we know are valuable, but which we first have to take care of this, or we lose everything. And that's where we're at. And that means constructing a program that goes from probably 450,000 people down to 350 or 300,000 people. And we know what we're doing there. We realize that we're taking and moving 3 or 4% of the organ population into a category of non-insured. We know there's cost shifts involved in all of this, no matter which way we go. And so people are aware of that. But the main thing we need to take away is we started with what is a bare minimum mandatory. We know what it does to the population served, and now we're trying to rebuild from that the things we've been talking about here. And to get to that point takes a lot of effort, but it's been worthwhile.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, well put. Exactly. Mr. Chair, if I may, the other thought that I wanted to give to Representative Greenlick in the issue of values, in addition to populate the values expressed through the OHP development process years ago on children and other vulnerable populations, the other dimension that we're looking at that I want to link back is laying the prioritized list on top of the mandatory the mandatory benefits, because the prioritized list in and of itself represents values in a hierarchy of service delivery. And we think that there's value in that and in constructing it, in fact, for a potential request to the feds to be able to use the list in combination with the mandatory minimum, because we could say that's using evidence-based medicine to save dollars to be able to buy additional optional benefits that the feds don't require. So in both those situations of populations and evidence-based medicine, a hierarchy of service need, we're trying to apply those, keep those in play, if you will.
I would just correct Representative Bates in one small manner, and that if we aren't forced to have a Medicaid.
Good point.
And so, I mean, you look at this, we don't have to participate in Medicaid. We wouldn't get the eligible funds, and we're certainly in no position to say no to that 40-60 match. But the good news here is that we're at least close to being able to have a Medicaid minimum, receive those additional federal dollars. But if we can't figure out how to at least buy the pharmaceutical benefit, we would be the only state in the union to have a Medicaid program without a pharmaceutical match. So that didn't make any sense, but the point being, we aren't forced to have a Medicaid system. Representative Bates, or Representative Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I still do not understand how you can confuse Representative Bates and myself.
You're just both so good looking that, I mean, you know, your radiance just blinds me.
I mean, the one thing I like about being with Representative Bates is comparatively I actually have hair. But
more. That's a relative statement.
It is a very relative statement.
You powder your head. That glare is starting to bother you.
We do. And I will say back in 99, Representative Back. Said on the floor of the House that he had an advantage over the rest of us because he was the only one that, at that point in time, that could comb his hair with a washcloth. But some of us are getting there. Barney had things mostly right, and I'm not going to belabor the points. He kind of missed a couple things there. But Mr. Chair, I just, after all these evenings with Barney, who has done an incredible job as a facilitator, as has Jeff, I just don't know how we could let him get out of here without making some reference to Kentucky Windage.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that may call for a response.
Yeah.
There are some metaphors. My father was born and raised in Tennessee, and in the black powder game, and I've never been a black powder shooter, but there's a phrase, Kentucky windage, that is, you estimate the wind going across your front of your target, and Tennessee elevation. Now, I've never used both phrases in the same meeting in one night because I didn't want to confuse anybody, but I do like to use Kentucky windage in lieu of swag. That's what it means.
Well, given the direction our budget's been going, I think it's the Tennessee elevation that's been the problem.
In fact, that actually raises one of the difficulties because the target is moving and changing before our eyes, and you know, less resources are available as we go forward. One thing I would like to point out is you look at the mandatory minimum population number there, 830, and we're going to go back into that number and see if we can't, you know, whittle that down in terms of being able to provide some of the same services, the same population. Are there efficiencies we can gain within a delivery system? We're probably going to lose that amount of money from the time we actually get this thing passed, expedited, and implemented. That's based on 24 months. So if on July 1 we're able to start this, that's a good number.
And all the new people that seem to be coming on from lower categories of eligibility is going to change it too.
And yeah, a lot of standard population is going to come, no question. But and that's the good news about this number is that is driven, you know, for the entire population. Mid-year, mid, you know, mid-biennium. But unless we're able to implement that July 1, the current system will remain in effect, which would be a more comprehensive, some would argue better, system, but it will cost more money as we go forward until we're able to get this phased in, or some iteration of this, hopefully more. The problems, the hill doesn't get, you know, the hill just gets steeper. Any other questions for Barney?
Not only does it get steeper, the gravel seems to get looser.
Yeah. Any other questions for Barney or Jeff? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your excellent presentation.
Good night.
And that is a factor. I mean, we've been doing this now for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
2 weeks every night.
We've done it for about a year the last 2 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, that way.
Any other questions among the committee, comments, discussions? Seeing no other business come before the committee, we are adjourned.